This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming up in this week's show, Norwegian eco-psychologist Per Espen Stoknes tells us why public concern about climate change may be falling even as the science becomes more certain. How to avoid thinking about climate change. Alternative energy Robert A. Staten says, yes, we can power the world with solar, and tells us how. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get going. Why has the campaign to get the public on board with climate change failed? On Radio EcoShock, we paid attention to the psychology, the way we think about energy and global warming. There's a new approach out from the Norwegian eco-psychologist Per Espen Stoknes. His book is called What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming. Per Stoknes, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Great being with you, Alex. Looking forward to speaking on this incredibly important topic.
Yes, it is. Now, you're described as an eco-psychologist. What is that?
Psychologists are typically involved with psychotherapy and inner stuff. Eco-psychologists kind of breaks down that opposition of inner and outer because what we think and how we act actually manifests in the world around us. Right now, the climate and ecology is being shaped by human thinking. So we see nature, humans, not as opposite, but as a continuum.
So why did you write this book?
Well, the question that really drives me is whether humans are inevitably short-term. You see, quite a few of my climate scientist colleagues have become very frustrated and, not to say exasperated, about going on and on about how serious this is and getting all the facts out, and people just seem to not take notice. And so we're short-term in our everyday lives, short-term in our democracies, short-term in our capitalism, and this makes them feel that we're doomed because humans are so short-term. And my quest or my writing this book has really been to explore and consider what are the conditions under which humans will actually act for the long term.
How is it possible that as the science becomes more clear about climate change, polls show people are less concerned about it compared to other problems like the economy?
Exactly. So that's the book actually starts with this, the mystery of the what I call the psychological climate paradox, which is that over the last 25 years, we've had more and more clear science, more certainty, yet people are less concerned today about climate change than they were back in 1989, at least according to surveys of Norway and the U.S. It doesn't apply for the whole world, so it mostly is a characteristic of the richer, democratic, English-speaking world, actually. And what I've done is to condense, let's say, 300 or 400 articles, scientific articles from psychology, from sociology, from social anthropology, into a very handy set of defenses or barriers, just five of them. I call them the five D's. That makes it easy for people to understand and then apply to a new way of talking about climate change.
So before we get to the five D's and your solutions, I think we have to overcome a different kind of climate denial that may be in the minds of some of our listeners. I have some listeners who believe civilization will have to crash before we can really cut emissions. And a few think humans will go extinct before the end of the century, and that'll solve the problem. I'll get some angry emails and blog posts just for letting you say there may be some ways out of this. Do you encounter resistance from people who insist we are doomed?
Yeah, actually, not a lot, luckily. I think most of us are longing for or hungering for some more positive stories because we've heard about doom for so long now, and it's, you know, more or less always been the end is near. But that overuse of the doom framing is actually one of the defenses against the climate issue itself. And today people are, let's say, experiencing apocalypse fatigue. So we really need more positive stories. And if people feel threatened by that, and I would accuse them about, you know, being somehow stuck in that one negative mindset.
What are the five D's that you are talking about?
In brief, these are psychological mechanisms that make us disengage from climate change and global warming challenges. So they are D for distant, doom, dissonance, denial, and I had to cheat a little bit on the fifth one, identity. So distance means that climate issue is experienced by people as being distant in time, because often climate scientists would say that, talk about the year 2100, or when they say the West Antarctica sheet is now melting and in 200 years we'll all be flooded. Well, that's pretty far off to watch. I mean, our everyday lives typically have a time span of a day or a week at most. So it just, you get this perception that it's way beyond my really focus, my field. It's also distant in space because climate communications typically picture melting glaciers, drowning polar bears, cyclones in the Pacific, or floods in Bangladesh. So we get the impression that climate change is really happening somewhere else, not where I live. Social impacts, too, are described as being hitting poor people, maybe living in New Orleans or in Philippines. I don't know them. I don't know anybody who knows them. And we know from psychology science that the longer the social distance, the less the ethical implications. And finally, climate is depicted as distant in responsibility because it's typically focused on these international negotiations where national or politicians or negotiators quarrel between them. And I don't know anybody of these people. I have no influence on them. And they don't care what I mean. So they're way beyond my scope of influence. And this perceived distance of the climate issue makes it feel less urgent, less personal, less near. And that's the first of the five defenses or the barriers that have to be overcome for a successful climate communications. Do you want me to head on with the second? Or?
Yes, please do. This is fascinating stuff.
Great. So even this doom story in itself has actually become a defense, and I'll explain to you why. Doom is typically coupled with the sentence, if we continue as today, then the world will burn, or then we will all get into a catastrophe. And it's also coupled with the sacrifice and the cost. It's costly to do something about it, and we have to sacrifice our lifestyles to appease this global apocalypse. The problem is that the more fear and guilt you induce into people, the more passive they become. This is something we know from psychology. Fear and guilt create passivity and not engagement. And further, we develop what I would call avoidance behaviors, such as if you're a kid and you steal a chocolate in the kitchen and the mother catches you, well, the next time you make sure you steal the chocolate that your mother can't see you. In the same way, we rapidly employ these automatic behaviors to filtering out, ignoring, looking somewhere else when we hear about another climate catastrophe coming supposedly our way. So the doom framing actually backfires on the issue. It creates less engagement. Thirdly, we have inherited, you know, lots of habits and lifestyles from the previous century, the 20th century. Yet we now have a new knowledge that this cheap oil, this cheap energy lifestyle doesn't really work. We heard that from everybody now. But when the way I live conflicts with the way I know I should live, and I can't do much about my behavior, then I get this dissonance state. And the dissonance is a very uncomfortable feeling. Maybe I feel like a hypocrite because, you know I should be doing this, yet I keep flying, I keep driving, I keep eating meat or whatever. And this makes us really want to doubt the climate science itself. So there's definitely been a well-funded, well-oiled, so to speak, misinformation campaign stating that, you know, it hasn't warmed since 1998, the climate is always changing, blah, blah, blah. This is very little brain power and very little facts behind these statements. Yet this supply seems to find an eager demand side. Some segments of the population, and almost half of us, actually want to believe this rather than wanting to believe the scientists. And I think dissonance is an important part of that explanation, because if we disbelieve the climate scientists who come there with doom, then we can feel better about ourselves and our behaviors. I feel less of a hypocrite because, well, if I say, well, you know, it's not that certain, there's this pause in global warming, maybe they got their models wrong, then suddenly I feel better about my old-time driving and flying, etc. You get that?
I do. And then you talk about identity as really kind of the core thing, your final D, if you will. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, because when enviros and climate scientists and others who engage this come with their message of, well, we have to put on more carbon taxes or we have to do more regulation, then these climate solutions actually challenge some of identity values and self-perceptions and ideological values that define people's self-identity. And because we may disagree with the solutions proposed, that is displaced onto the climate science itself. So I actually use my intelligence and my knowledge to reinterpret the facts so they better conform or are consistent with the values I believe in, such as a free market, a small government, and freedom of choice in consumption. So if new information requires us to change our identities, to change our values, well, the information is likely to lose. We know this from psychotherapy. Identity tends to override the facts. And then we experience resistance in these calls for a change in our values and self-identity. And what's been very unhelpful is the polarization, let me say, the whole transformation of the climate science into the culture wars of America, where if you're pro-climate, it's more divisive now than both abortion and gay sex.
Do you think public beliefs about climate change are substantially different in Europe and Scandinavia compared to North America?
This is part of the surprise because, like in Norway, we also have a petroleum-based economy. And there's been a decline of concern in Norway as well, back from 1989 to today. So Norway is quite actually like America, Canada, Australia, and the UK. But other countries in Europe, particularly in the south, such as Portugal, Spain, and also Germany, have mindsets that are much more engaged. So there actually seem to be a certain correlation between speaking English and wanting to disbelieve climate.
Wow, that's serious. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest Norwegian psychologist Per Espen Stoknes. We're talking about why the climate campaign has failed and his new book, What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming. Let's get to some of the solutions. You do suggest some things. What about the way social networking could work positively for us?
Yeah, and this is the good news because in addition to identifying these barriers in climate communications, social science researchers have also identified what actually works. So we now know how to create the shift that is needed. And I also condensed this research into five main strategies that all start with an S for simplicity. So it's social networks you mentioned, making the frames more supportive and simple actions, better stories, and new signals. So let me briefly walk you through the first one, particularly the social networks. This has to do with what we call applying social norms, social media, and social networks. And the best example is maybe, let's imagine there's a neighborhood and suddenly one of the houses there get a solar panel on the roof. Then it's very clear from the data that the likelihood of the houses near to this house also getting a solar panel is very high compared to the average of houses. So rooftop solar is really proven contagious. And the reason why this works is that when we do our daily actions, a lot of the motivation comes from what we believe other people that I know would do in the same situation. And this is how we could define a social norm, is the belief that others do the same, and particularly those that I care about. So another example would be, for instance, the Green Sports Alliance, which is a new initiative that works with sports organizations to make their events much greener, and also their leading sports stars, sports heroes, behave more environmentally friendly. Because when then the scores of people who love baseball, ice hockey, soccer, football, basketball, you name it, when they get to an event and they experience that this is green too, then they want to be green too because the sports heroes are. And this is how social norms influence our behaviors, and it completely overcomes the barrier of distance, because earlier, if climate is described as in PPM values for the year 2100 or a few degrees hotter in a decade or so, who cares? But if people I know actually do something about it, then it becomes near, personal, relevant, and urgent for me as well. And the extent of this was demonstrated in an experiment by a professor called Bob Cialdini, a professor of marketing psychology. He took hundreds of households and put them into four conditions. First, household group were told they should conserve power for the sake of sustainability. It's good for the planet. The second group were told they should conserve energy for the sake of future generations, their children and their grandchildren. Third group were told they should cut energy because it's profitable. It's good for your power bill. And fourthly, they were told to, or they weren't told actually, they were just showed what their own consumption was relative to their neighbors. So out of these four conditions, sustainability, future generations, profitability, and what your neighbors do, it was consistently the fourth one that made the biggest impact. So his whole point is that people don't mind conserving energy, but they want to be acknowledged for conserving energy. And that's what created the sustained behavioral motivation. So by positioning the climate message inside our social networks and social norms, we have a much larger impact, and then we build support for climate policy bottom up.
Well, we'll just have time to talk about another one of your suggestions, which you call nudging. Could you explain that, please?
Sure. If you go into shop, or if you consider buying something or going somewhere to travel, it's very hard to know what is the most climate-friendly option. And you would have to spend a lot of time to figure out which products on the aisles are the best for the climate. It takes a lot of effort and, shall we say, using our slow cognitive system. However, if we could redesign our decisions so that it was simple and default to pick the most climate-friendly, then you could easily switch millions of decisions towards the best one. So the bad news is that today we make a lot of mindless and destructive choices, and the good news is that we could just as easily make a lot of mindless and constructive or good choices. So just to pick one example, if all printers in the US and Canada had as a default value to print double-sided rather than one-sided, then you would reduce power consumption by maybe 15-20% immediately. That's equivalent to pulling more than 200,000 cars off the road each year. Also, we did some studies in Norway to see how you could make people buy more energy-efficient household appliances, such as air conditioners, dry tumblers, washing machines, etc. And by just replacing the price tag from the sales price in big font to the life cycle cost, which shows your cost of both purchasing this and using it over 7 to 10 years, then you put the life cycle cost in big fonts and the today's sales price in a small font. In that way, it's very easy to pick what's cheapest in the long term. And thus, we can nudge people, just by the design of the label, to switch from buying what is cheapest today to buying the most energy efficient and the less costly over the long term. And this reduced the household appliance power consumption by 5%, just shifting the price label design. And is 5% much? It might not sound as much, but if that was applied to all EU equipment, the entire EU, it would reduce emissions by 10 million tons of CO2 per year. So that really scales nicely. And there are lots of examples like this in my book about easy nudges that we could do to influence people's behavior. Mind you, this doesn't solve the climate problem all by itself. But what it does do is that it reduces the dissonance we talked about. Because previously, we were often getting a backlash on our climate engagement because we are living in, high fossil energy way. But if we could make more and more actions that were climate friendly by default and making it easy, then that would drive the attitudes towards supporting more structural changes as well.
So when I think, though, about beloved species now threatened with extinction, things like lions, elephants, and most recently scientists announced many large wild herbivores may go away, grief does sound like the appropriate emotional response, is it?
I think it really is. Grief and maybe anger and also depression, because, you know, I also get this feeling from time to time, you know, well, we're really in a very difficult state today. When I take that in and when I open up to that, a huge kind of sadness or something called, I call it great grief, runs through me. And it really brings me low. And now many of us, I've learned, and also myself, would typically, I hate being in that state. Let's get positive again. So we kind of force ourselves to some kind of Pollyanna type of optimism. And I think that's not really a good way of doing it. I think rather we have to really feel this despair and mourn it and dwell with it and let it kind of do what it needs to do with us, flow through us. Being a psychotherapist myself and have worked with psychology, what really is the surprise is that if you manage to kind of mourn that or go through that despair, somehow your heart seems to kind of crack open on the other side. And the numbing, the numbing that we're experiencing from our busy daily lives and that sadness that kind of seems to be overwhelming may crack open finally, and we reconnect again with what's still here in a much deeper way. And I think going through that despair, going through that sadness is necessary to be able to quit care in a sustained long-term way. And I write a lot about that in the last part of my book.
On Radio EcoShock, the scientists I talk with are blunt and they're bleak about the path we're on, the need for gigantic changes to avert dangerous climate change. And, you know, from the pole to pole, these are the facts. Are the experts wrong to spread that message? Should they just keep their concerns within scientific circles?
The problem is not that story in itself, but the monotheism of that story, that's the only story they tell. I think we need more stories and more storytellers that include different versions of the future and different versions of hope. So when you're really faced with hell, what we need is a story of the I have a dream type. So it's a failure of the imagination, really, not to be able to tell anything else than that doom story. And I think both from an economic, from a religious, and from an ecological point of view, we can craft good stories about what values we still have and how they can be saved and how that can move us towards a better future. So, for instance, let's do the economists and the economic story, because I work a lot with economists and a lot with corporations. I think also climate change is not just a catastrophe. It's also the biggest business opportunity of this century, because the way we did things in the previous century, the 20th century, was insanely wasteful. We really throw away 99% of all we take. But you can go on moralizing about that, or you can flip it over, and then you see that, wow, reducing that wastefulness is actually the biggest business opportunity of this century. We can do better than that. We can achieve much more economic value creation by using much less resources. And this is the new wave of innovation that's really starting to flow through and overwhelm the old business structures of the 20th century. And businesses that can deliver dramatic resource productivity improvements at scale will really become the great companies of this century. So the petroleum industry and the old wasteful ones, they will become like Kodak. They will become like the horse carriage manufacturers from before the car came. They will become more like Nokia after the smart iPhone of Apple. It will become like the blockbusters after the introduction of Netflix. So if they don't change, the innovation will blow them away. And this is a message that's now really getting through to the businesses. So they're now not just doing environmental things because activists are screaming at them. Well, they never did that anyway. But today, they're seeing that they have to, in order to be competitive, they have to improve their resource productivity. So now they're not starting to compete against each other. It's IKEA against Walmart. It's Apple against Google. And these forces are much, much greater than what any environmentalist can achieve. So smart investors are now moving their money. We see what's happening to Elon Musk with the Solar City, Tesla, etc. And Warren Buffett is throwing tens of billion dollars into the solar and the energy revolution. And power companies are starting to turn around. So huge things are on the way. And we need to spell out this and how this actually contributes to much better resource-efficient society after 2030.
We've been talking about the puzzle of climate change in our minds with the Norwegian eco-psychologist Per Espen Stoknes. To dig deeper, look for his new book, What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming. It's from Chelsea Green Publishing. I'll have links to Per Espen and his work in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock. You have been inspiring.
Thanks, Alex. Great talking to you and good questions. Thanks.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Coming up, the way out with solar and other inconvenient truths.
Radio EcoShock.
If we stopped using fossil fuels today, the climate would still heat up somewhat and civilization would crash. That's a nasty problem, and we need a roadmap out. Robert Staten says solar power is the path forward. He's been teaching about energy and solar power for decades at California colleges and the University of California in Santa Cruz. Those years of expertise are drawn together in his new book, Power Shift, From Fossil Energy to Dynamic Solar Power. Robert Staten, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, we can assume most of our listeners know why we have to stop using fossil fuels, aside from the ground pollution that kills millions and limited supplies eventually, and scientists have warned that our carbon emissions can cause cataclysmic climate change. So what would happen if we stopped burning fossil fuels all of a sudden, and is that even conceivable?
That's not possible. Our modern civilization is entirely dependent on fossil fuels. Just to take one example, our modern food production and delivery systems run on fossil fuels for the farm machinery, transport, food processing, and retailing. All of that would grind to a halt. Stores have about 3 days' worth of food, so if deliveries stop, it would be a short time until desperation would lead to the collapse of society.
Well, I agree with you. Now, in your book, you lay out four stark choices we all need to make if we must phase out fossil fuels. Can you just list off those four directions for us, and then we'll take them one at a time?
Sure. I saw two necessary conditions that any future energy source must meet. It had no carbon dioxide emissions, and it must be big enough to meet our energy needs. So I saw four approaches that could satisfy those conditions. One is to go back to the energy systems we used before fossil fuels, use carbon capture and sequestration, better known as clean coal, use nuclear power, or use solar power.
Okay, let's start with number one. Various pundits like James Howard Kunstler suggest humans willy-nilly will return to an age made by hand. Do you think we can go back to technologies humans used before coal power?
Well, if they are willing to do a lot of hard physical work, I think a few individuals could do it, but not with the populations that we have today. Just taking the food production example again, replacing the farm tractors that we have today running on fossil fuels with horses requires feeding those horses, and that alone, just to the land needed to feed the horses, would not only take up all the farmland we have, but twice that amount. So it's really an impossible situation. I think this option would only come about if our civilization does collapse, but that would not be something that we would choose to do.
And your second step is to capture and store the carbon from fossil fuel burning. The United Nations Panel on Climate Change assumes we will do this. Is that a rational plan?
Well, it seems like a good idea. Since carbon dioxide is the source of the problem, why not just capture it and pump it underground, and then we don't have to change anything else? But it can only work for stationary sources like power plants, not for moving cars and trucks. So it's not a complete solution. When pumped underground, that carbon dioxide has to stay there without leaking back into the atmosphere for decades or even centuries if it's going to work. And that certainly has never been tested. And the volumes of gas are unbelievable. The volume of carbon dioxide gas emitted worldwide is about 15 times the volume of the world's oil production. So while we would have one huge industry extracting oil from the ground, we would need a much larger industry to pump 15 times that volume back into the ground and making sure we don't trigger earthquakes. So I don't see this as a real solution.
Okay, number three. Some scientists, from James Lovelock to James Hansen, say we need massive amounts of nuclear energy to get off fossil fuels. What do you think?
I'm a physicist who once thought that nuclear power was the logical replacement for fossil fuels. But the more I looked into it, the more I began to oppose it. First, there is the danger. We have had three major nuclear accidents in three decades: Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima. For many countries, three strikes and you are out, and they are abandoning nuclear power. Then there is the nuclear waste problem. Reactors routinely generate the most dangerous material on the planet in huge quantities, and we have not yet figured out how to store it safely for the centuries it takes to cool down. You can't just bury it because it will eventually leak into the groundwater. The storage system really should have been in place since the beginning, but even 50 years later, we don't have it, because the problem is so difficult. And using nuclear energy to generate electricity really borders on the absurd. The electricity gets used up within seconds of being generated, running our toasters and air conditioners and such. But we are saddling many generations to come with the job of caring for the long-lived nuclear waste. This is, in my opinion, grossly unfair to future generations.
So as a longtime researcher and teacher of solar power, you say it's going to work. You know some of us have doubts about that. Why don't you lay out the most common arguments people bring up when you tell them and why they say solar can't work?
Well, some think it isn't big enough, but that is simply not based on fact. If you were to add up all the energy stored in the fossil fuel reserves in the world, coal, oil, and natural gas, the sun delivers that much energy to Earth every 5 days, so it's certainly big enough. Some think it costs too much. That argument is fading quickly as the price of solar equipment comes down. And remember that we are comparing the cost of clean solar to the cost of dirty fossil fuels. If we were to pay the full cost of cleaning up fossil fuels instead of just tolerating their pollution so we had a fair comparison, then solar would be much cheaper already. And some point out that solar energy is intermittent while our economy runs 24/7.
Yeah, but can we overcome that? I mean, the sun doesn't shine always, and it certainly doesn't shine at night.
Well, let me ask you a question. Can you take a shower when it isn't raining? Of course, because we build water storage systems that capture water when it comes to make it available when it is needed. Likewise, a solar future requires installing energy storage systems to do the same thing with energy. We didn't have to do that with fossil fuels because they come with energy storage built in, a few million years worth. I devote a whole chapter in my book to all the exciting research going on right now in energy storage, from new batteries to flywheels to conversion to liquid fuels that can be stored. Energy storage will be a necessary part for this transition to succeed.
And we can store it even with water. We just pump it uphill and let it run back downhill through turbines. That's another way to store it as well.
It sure is, exactly.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and our guest is Robert Staten, author of the book Power Shift, From Fossil Energy to Dynamic Solar Power. What about heavy industry, Robert, like mining and metal manufacturing? Can solar do that job?
Well, any industry that runs on electricity can run just as easily on solar-generated electricity. It won't make any difference as long as they can get enough of it. For example, many steel foundries use electric arc furnaces to make high-quality steel because they don't introduce impurities like coal does. That steel could be made from solar electricity. Some industries need liquid and gas fuels for their processing, and those can also be produced from solar energy. First, you generate the electricity and use the electricity to produce hydrogen. And then through various chemical processes of heat and pressure, you can convert that to whatever liquid or gas fuel is needed. Those are processes that already exist today. But it is expensive relative to the fossil fuels coming out of the ground, which is why we don't use it much now.
This past week, the Brookings Institute held a conference on a new energy path for India. Hundreds of millions of people there don't have electricity from the grid, and the government is still planning and building more coal-fired power plants. What could they do instead?
India is following the traditional development model by imitating the developed countries with centralized power plants. But then they will also have to build an expensive grid to distribute that electricity to all the towns and villages. And, of course, they will be faced with replacing those coal plants in 10 or 20 years because of their carbon emissions. I think they should just skip the coal step entirely and go straight to solar. Since solar is a distributed energy source, it can reach all of those villages before the grid can be built.
Right. They can put the panels right on top of the places that they're needed. I think that's a beautiful solution for India. I hope that they will listen to that. Another big question is whether solar power can replace itself. Suppose we build big solar plants today, as are being built in California and Pakistan, other places in the world, but we use fossil fuels to do it. What happens 25 or 30 years from now when those plants need to be replaced?
We certainly need to invest fossil energy today to start the solar transition. But as solar equipment comes online, we can use the solar energy it generates to build solar equipment. and a kind of breeder plant. One of the first PV plants that was built in the 1980s actually demonstrated that.
When I spoke with Richard Heinberg a few weeks ago, he warned that increased solar by homeowners would eventually force a major restructuring of the big corporations who now hold an energy monopoly. In his scenario, the wealthy go off grid because they can afford to, while the poorest in society have to pay more and more to maintain an inefficient grid system. Robert Staten, what are your thoughts?
Well, I don't think that's probably a realistic scenario. There is no question that the role of the electric utility companies will change during this transition. But the traditional role where the utility company generated all the electricity and handled all of the distribution, that's already obsolete. Energy deregulation enacted over the last couple decades by many governments has created a market for energy production from many sources, and the utility companies already buy into that and distribute it. So I see that process continuing and the utility companies transitioning more into providing services, two in particular. They will distribute electricity, but now they will be doing it in both directions instead of just one way. And they can provide energy storage services, so individuals don't have to install batteries in their garage for their solar panels. We are already transitioning to a smart grid, which is basically power with communication combined in both directions. And that will help immensely with this changeover to a variety of different distributed energy systems.
Another problem, Robert, is more difficult for me to express. For example, scientist Tim Garrett says that any shift in technology just means more industrial activity and inevitably more fossil fuel emissions. Can we overcome the initial burst of fossil fuels required to start down the solar path on a big scale?
Absolutely. There was a study by the Institute for Policy Research and Development that examined the energy burden of building a solar-based energy system. They estimated that by devoting just 1% of the current fossil fuel energy use to this transition, we could build all the solar and wind equipment to transition completely in 40 years. And during that transition, it becomes self-sustaining if about 10% of the solar capacity is dedicated to building solar, continuing the breeder concept that I described earlier.
Robert, do you have solar power personally, and does that question matter for the overall development of solar power?
Yes, my wife and I live in a home powered by photovoltaic panels. We turned the system on April 28, 1997, so we just celebrated 18 years of solar living. Over those years, I have given tours of my home to hundreds of people, many of whom went on to do solar themselves. The more people see that it works, the more people will want to do it, and I think that's driving a good part of its growth.
Now, I asked that question because I'm wondering if you see the coming solar shift happening at the government and corporate large-scale level, or more from millions of home and farm electricity users seeing a better and cheaper option in solar.
I think the balance will be more on the latter. That'll be a lot of distributed systems at homes and commercial operations and farms. But it will be a mix of both. Photovoltaic panels are modular, so they work just as well in a small system as in a large system. I envision rooftop systems in neighborhoods and towns supplying most of their own local energy, while the big centralized solar and wind arrays can be used to power industrial operations that need more electricity than they can generate on site.
Yeah, I know the U.S. military is already looking into solar in a big way. Now, it seems one reason solar became so big in Germany and France was a guaranteed good price for any excess power that was produced. Plus, there were finance packages to get us past the first big installation cost. Is there any hope of seeing that in North America?
It is no longer hope. It is already happening. Germany used something called feed-in tariffs, or FIT, which pays a premium price for solar electricity to encourage its initial growth, with that price declining over time to encourage you to act sooner rather than later. In fact, Ontario already has a FIT program, actually two, one for large energy developers and a micro-FIT program for homeowners and other small operators. And if you don't want to pay the large upfront costs, you can lease a system. In that case, a third party installs and maintains the solar system on your roof, and you pay a monthly fee that is lower than your current utility bill. You don't own the system, but you get many of the benefits. What you don't get with a lease is the free energy that comes after the system has paid back its initial costs. Since the panels typically last 30 years, that can be significant in the long run.
So I thought the first and largest advances in alternative energy in America were in wind rather than solar. I'm thinking of the big installations in Texas and even in Alberta, Canada. Why are you big on solar rather than wind power?
Well, wind power works really well in a really windy place, a place where the wind bothers you a lot. But most places are not that windy. But solar photovoltaics, they work almost everywhere if you're not blocked by the buildings or trees. And PV panels don't move or make noise, so you can mount them on your roof, on overhead racks, over parking lots, and along highway medians. So I think solar PV has much greater potential to grow, big enough to meet our energy needs. And in my book, I wanted to stress a solar source that the average person could participate in.
So your book, Power Shift, tells us a lot about transition. According to recent science, we have very little time left to go before we go past some awful climate tipping points. How fast is your proposed transition, and is it fast enough?
I outline one scenario in my book that says we could reach 100% solar by the year 2060, and other studies have shown pretty much similar time frames. Is that fast enough? Well, I can't answer that with any certainty, and of course, neither can anyone else. But we are already on a very rapid growth path for solar, with solar PV growing about 45% per year for the last 4 years. The problem really is that we're just getting a late start. Had we pursued it in the 1980s during the first energy crisis, instead of falling back to cheap oil like we did, we would be much further along today.
Well, let's go forward 10 years to 2025. What do you think the energy scene will look like?
I think in 10 years, the cost of solar photovoltaic energy will be cheaper than fossil fuel energy, including coal. Right now, some people are willing to invest a little extra money to help the environment or to make a better world for their children. But by 2025, solar will simply be the cheapest energy, and everyone will be scrambling to get it. In fact, so much so that the demand may temporarily push the price up. I think every surface with good sun exposure will be viewed as a potential source of income by the owner. Buildings probably will be designed with rooftop power generations rather than just tacking it on as an afterthought like we do today. And I think we will see energy storage systems coming online to even out the supply. But we probably won't actually see them. They won't be very visible if the utility companies handle it as a service.
Well, some of that is already happening in Europe. I know that in Germany, you know, every barn roof practically has solar panels on it. And then in France, they just passed a law saying that any new construction either had to have a living roof where it's all green or solar on it. So we're starting to see the beginnings of what you just predicted. Now, some people insist that life will have to be just like it is now, only with renewable energy instead of fossil fuel. I suggest we have to make some big changes, yeah, even sacrifices, to save a livable climate. Do we have to give up some things or change our expectations?
Yes, you will have to give up your incandescent light bulbs. Now, I don't mean to sound flippant. I'm just using that as an example of how we will have to give up wasteful energy habits. The incandescent bulb is a 19th century technology and is only about 5% efficient in converting electricity to light, where compact fluorescents and LED lights are 5 times as efficient. Getting to a 100% solar future will come sooner if we can bring down the energy demand as fast as we ramp up the energy supply. And we have a lot of room for improvement in energy efficiency without altering our lifestyles. For example, the per capita energy use in Europe is half that of the U.S. and Canada for a similar lifestyle, and no one would consider them deprived. And I found when I started generating my own electricity that I was much more motivated to use it efficiently so that I could extend my precious resource as far as possible. It seemed saving electricity from the utility company just didn't motivate me as much.
Is there anything else you would like to talk to us about?
Sure. This transition to solar power should be viewed as the last energy transition we will need to make. the basic solar resource, the sun, is good for another 5 billion years. If we maintain and replace solar equipment, we won't have to go looking for a new energy source in 50 or 100 or even 1,000 years. If you look at it in terms of human generations, the fossil fuel age started around 1800 and will end by 2100 if we are to survive. That's 300 years or about 12 generations for the whole fossil fuel age. The solar age can last hundreds or thousands of generations. So we are the pioneers. And I think that's something you could tell your grandchildren.
That is inspiring. We've been talking with author and educator Robert Staton. His helpful new book is Power Shift, From Fossil Energy to Dynamic Solar Power. Probably because of his long experience teaching all things solar, I found his book accessible and useful right away. Find links to follow up on this interview in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Robert, thank you for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We like things to be simple. For example, we think society is emitting too much carbon dioxide, endangering us all with climate change. Dr. Alan Rozich is knocking at the door to make this all a bit more difficult. His first new book is called Other Inconvenient Truths Beyond Global Warming. Let's investigate. Alan Rozich, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Nice to be here.
Now, to start with, Alan, are you saying climate change is not a critical issue?
Climate change, the way I view it, Alex, is a symptom. It's an issue, but it's a symptom. And I think that the underlying cause is really the lack of using renewable resources as part of our functionality for society. The thinking is that ultimately that the push to use renewables will not be for environmental reasons. It'll be to maintain societal functionality as economies around the world continue to expand and there's increased pressure to get resources, driving up costs so that, I don't want to call it a fallback, so that the option is to go to renewables so that businesses can keep their costs and pricing structure and generally societal functionality in line.
Well, even from a national viewpoint, why keep importing oil and building up all those trade imbalances if you can get it from the sun directly?
Absolutely. And as I talk about in the book, there's not going to be one solution. There's no silver bullet. There's going to be an assembly of solutions, a cobbling of solutions to meet different resource requirements. But the underlying thinking is that solving the resource issue with renewables will go a long way at attenuating global warming and CO2 production.
Well, let's dive right in. You've said humans are heading into a new and dangerous situation, which you call the super nexus. What is that?
The super nexus is a confluence of three things. It's basically the fact that human society is looking at a three-way challenge, and that challenge consists of the desire to have economic and environmental sustainability. At the same time, you have economic and population expansion, and then there's the concomitant depletion of resources and increased cost and decreased resource availability. It's the resource thing that, although it's a three-way nexus, it's the resource aspect that really raises its ugly head. And a lot of this thinking is not just espoused by myself. Folks like the McKinsey Group down in San Francisco have done a lot of modeling on where resources are going and looking at what's going to happen with the increased populations of India and China, not just the increase in populations, but those populations jumping into higher levels of technological functionality. And then as you go into higher technological functionality as a society, then what happens is you want better food or you use more energy, and that puts a strain on resources, thus putting the strain on costs for everybody.
Well, thanks to the drought in California, most of us know there is a water problem, but isn't that local rather than a global threat?
I think the California manifestation is a manifestation that is going to be seen around the world. Basically, we are getting stuck with water. There is no energy, for example, in theory anyway, you can get as much energy as you need from the sun. Water, what we have is what we have, and we cannot get more of it. And what people seem to forget, they say, well, okay, let's go and get water out of the oceans. There's a limit there. There's a traffic cop there is that will not allow you to take more water out of, say, the rivers or the oceans, because what you start to do is then you impinge on the local ecology. And if you knock that out, you have other catastrophic consequences. And there are some folks that use the term called peak ecological water. You cannot take so much water out of an environment and that once you go past that point, then the ecology may be irreparably damaged.
So in some different countries, you've been on the ground with solutions to reclaim water. Can you tell us about your experience in that?
Yeah, the first thing that people do, and it's interesting. I think I was listening to one of your previous broadcasts, and the gentleman was talking about efficiency. For example, if you go to Australia or Singapore, for example, and you'll listen to the television, they have commercials about, hey, if you left the faucet on X number of seconds extra, or you took a shower this many minutes longer, you've wasted this many liters of water. So it's kind of a public awareness campaign that they have focused on getting people on efficiency of water use as number one. Then after that, then you have a choice of trying to find different sources of water. And unfortunately, where it's going to all go is we're going to have to use recycled water. That's the sum and substance of it. And one of the articles that I saw, I think it was in the, it's referenced somewhere in my book, I think it was in the New York Times, it was titled, "You're Drinking What?" And talking about the need that we're going to have to use recycled water ultimately.
So that's like cleaning up sewage water and using it again.
Correct. And as unfathomable as that may seem, if you think about it, when you desalinate seawater, that's much cleaner than normal drinking water. So cleaning up sewage water to make sure that it's consumable and it has no bad health effects is not a big stretch. It's more of a psychological stretch.
I agree with you. Now, beyond water, there's also the situation with metal scarcity. Did you look into that?
Yeah, metals, like other resources, they're what one would call a conservative pollutant. That's not a political term. It means that that pollutant is not changed. It's not chemically altered. So what you see is, and I think it was a company by the name of Arcadis, they did a pretty extensive evaluation of renewable economies that would pop up in different parts of Europe. And one of the examples that should be familiar to us all is recycling aluminum. One of the reasons that recycling aluminum is so attractive is that it only costs 5% of the energy to recycle aluminum and make it into new product than the energy cost to be able to have to make it out of bauxite. So those kind of scenarios are going to be playing out more and more, and folks are going to be looking at doing recycling of metals and things like that. It's going to be more of a business that's more the core part of the economy than actually going after what I call old economy resources.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with author Alan Rozich talking about his book, Other Inconvenient Truths Beyond Global Warming. I worry most people won't understand the real impacts of climate change on water and energy. I mean, even the scientists are being surprised lately. And these things can feed on each other. You get feedback loops and the problems kind of ricochet around in different directions. How do we even describe that problem for people?
I think you have to think of it in terms that the folks at McKinsey came up with a good term. It's called interlinkages, that resources, particularly as we go into stress situations, as the world is now with burgeoning economies and whatnot and lower levels of low-hanging resource fruit on the ground, resources become increasingly interlinked. For example, you need water to make energy. You need energy to make water. And then when it comes to agriculture, you need water to make food, but you also need fertilizer to make food, and you need energy and water to make fertilizer. So in that kind of thinking, everything's interlinked. And that's why if you think about some situations where, let's say, you have an environment that is dry and there's a lack of water, some energy alternatives, you want to look at the energy alternative that has the least amount of water requirement. So it's no surprise that wind energy is quite a favorite in Texas. And that's kind of another example of the nexus working in reverse, where people are putting in that as a renewable alternative because it does not require water.
Are there other threats, Alan, that lie in wait for us to form the super nexus that you've written about?
Well, there are some of the threats that are there would be things like being careful about, in at least in our water systems, that we are discharging, for example, small quantities of compounds that are either man-made or they're in nature that have very profound effects on aquatic life and humans in terms of modifying endocrinal functionality. So these compounds are called endocrine disruptor compounds. Maybe that's not directly relatable to global warming, but it is a threat that has emerged over the years because of everybody being so packed in tight, and then our use of cosmetics and pharmaceuticals, and then those materials pass through water systems, they go into the water systems. That's one example that I can think of right off the top of my head.
Now, in your book, you suggested reducing CO2 emissions won't come from governments or climate treaties, but from big business. For me, that's kind of a scary thought since, well, this complex of consumerism and big business got us into this mess, and some industry has fought off serious action on emissions reduction. Why do you look to business for solutions?
I think that the reason I'm looking at it that way is I don't think that I'm looking at business to embrace things out of because it's the flavor of the day. The argument is it's an economic argument. So if you're a business, and you can start to see some of this, but there's some surprising companies out there doing really interesting things with renewable resources. For example, Walmart has the second largest solar installation base in the United States. And people like that would not be making these moves towards renewables just because somebody in Hollywood says to do it. I think the fundamental aspect is that renewables provide a couple of things to businesses. They're ultimately going to provide a more cost-effective source of resources. And then the other thing they provide is price security. And then the other thing that people are looking at these days, it's called resource security. Okay, so if you're a business and you have to go locate somewhere, you know, say you're an agricultural business and you need to locate somewhere, and you're not sure if you can get shipments of fertilizer in, you're going to have a tough day. You are basically kind of rolling the dice with a source that you have no control of. Whereas if you have a renewable mechanism or technology in place, then you can renew those resources and you have not just price security, but then you have resource security. And I think you're going to see more businesses looking at resource security, which means in order to keep their shareholders happy, they're going to have to keep the have resource security, and that's what's going to compel them to move down that road.
The book is Other Inconvenient Truths Beyond Global Warming, and it's available in all the usual places. Alan Rozich, thank you for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Alex, it's been my pleasure, and I appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting. Tick, tick, tick. We are out of time for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Check out our website at ecoshock.org, the blog at ecoshock.info, and our SoundCloud page. I'm Alex. Thank you for caring about your world. Tick, 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 tick.